Hi, everybody, and thank you very much for tuning into Telich Talks this week. Courtney Dewalter just smashed the women's course record at the iconic Western States 100-mile ultramarathon. It's the granddaddy of them all, many people say. She did it while flashing her million-megawatt smile the entire way. 15 hours and 29 minutes broke the record by around an hour's time, which is absolutely a remarkable achievement from an amazing athlete. I point out Courtney because, well, number one, I'm still very much connected to the sport of ultra running. And number two, Courtney's personality parallels, in a way, the personality of our next guest. Telich Talks, by the way, is three episodes away from 100 total episodes. And Pam Rickard, she was one of my first guests on the pod back in 2019. She is an accomplished marathoner. She's run more than 100 marathons. You'll see her at the Boston Marathon each and every year. She's run a bunch of ultra marathons as well, including a 7-day adventure in the Gobi Desert and a 100-kilometer trek through the Alps from Italy to France. She's all over the place. She's a Northeast Ohio native, and she is the director of active engagement for the Heron Project. This organization focuses on personal wellness. And it's amazing, folks, that she came to join that team, considering how low her life had gotten to her because of addiction. For your consumption today, parts of our conversation on episode 16 back in May of 2019. Pam says, quote, "I don't run to stay sober, but I get to because I am." The effervescent and always positive Pam Rickard, right here on Telich Talks. Pam, you are an ambassador for the sport of running. What's that been like?
Wow, that's a kind word, actually. I like being called an ambassador for the sport of
running.
What else
should I call you?
I have many titles, many names, some good, some bad, some in between. I'm an ambassador for the sport because of much more for what it's given me,
sure,
rather than what I've been able to give it. But it's been along with me on my journey, I think, and that's why I kind of come by it naturally, because I started running as a dare, as a joke, when we were at Ohio University, and I entered a 5K as a joke. One drunken night, to be honest with you, and the next morning we decided, okay,
we're drunken really night good. In college.
Oh, I know, it was a rare concept. Occurrence, but it's a little bit ironic now that I'm actually a sober runner. But yeah. So it was pretty horrible, and I think I lost my cookies and the whole bit. But there was something about it I didn't hate, so I continued. Running just recreationally, and then it took me through pregnancies and jobs, and then through recovery from alcoholism. So the neat thing about the sport to me is not only the personal satisfaction, the grace, the growth, the gratitude that I get from it, but what I see in others. I mean, you know, it sounds a little bit corny, but I love the sport so much because it connects people. It literally does connect people, and it's, to me, it's the great equalizer too, because you can be any age, any shape, any weight, any gender, and any economic background, pretty much, and you can, it's a very simple, welcoming, loving environment.
Well, Pam, you grew up on the East Side.
Yes.
And you were obviously active as a young lady, but you kind of started to go down that path where you were, drinking too much. And
yes.
What led you to that? What you know, what were some of the factors?
Yeah, actually, John, long story short is I grew up on the East Side. I grew up in, was born in Willoughby, graduated from Mentor High. You know, had a pretty typical charmed existence in terms of, well, you know, my parents were divorced and I was all upset about that quite a bit. But overall, though, I was very well taken care of. I got great grades. I, you know, went to Ohio University. I never ran in high school or college, though. I was very much one of those, you know, it was the late 70s, early 80s, and I looked every bit the part. With the big hair, the makeup, I wouldn't have sweat to, you know, for any amount of money, honestly. I mean, I love that old me.
What is that?
No. We would, I don't know if you remember, I'm really dating myself now, but there was this little place called Elaine Powers for women, right? And you'd go in there and you'd kind of like, it was almost like a Saturday Night Live skit. You know, you'd do a few moves and go, wow, I worked out. Anyway, so that was about it for me. And maybe a Jane Fonda video in the 80s. But when I started running, it was just something that I'm not a good athlete, but I can run. And so I kind of found my thing. And but when I was in high school and college, I partied. And I know that I truly have the disease of alcoholism and was an alcoholic from the first time I drank at 14 years old. But that's all hindsight. And I really didn't know that, nor did I acknowledge it until many, many years later. So I what they call a high functioning alcoholic. It actually kept me sicker much longer than I wish it had, because I was successful. And I could run. I ran 7 marathons active in my alcoholism. I graduated from OU and got a job in Roanoke, Virginia at the Roanoke Times. And honestly, married Tom. We had three amazing kids. And so it wasn't the typical story you think of, oh, the drunk mom or the woman who just was losing it all because of alcohol. I never drank when I was pregnant, breastfeeding, or training for a marathon.
So kids involved. You had the wherewithal and the mindset to back off on that stuff.
Absolutely. So I thought I had a handle on it, even though I would black out, even though I knew deep down in my inside that I didn't like the progression.
Okay.
But I also honestly felt like I could get a handle on it. And one day turns into the next, and I kept failing at getting a handle on it. And so
kicking it down the road.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and it did affect my running, but I honestly, as I talk to many runners that are in recovery, it's kind of the last thing to go. I mean, I do remember running and physically being sick, but I wasn't going to not run. Oh, yes.
They say they knew they were kind of spiraling down this little dungeon to hell.
Absolutely.
But yet they
circling
kept on
the drain, but
circling
you continue running. Absolutely. I've heard that story in many, many varieties. It's interesting, John. One thing about the disease of addiction, that, and now fortunately 13 years sober, I've heard a lot of stories, and I've been fortunate enough to work in the recovery industry as well. And the one thing that about the disease that kind of, especially when I talk to runners, that's comforting in a way, is that there's really nothing new under the sun. I mean, there are new drugs, there is an epidemic of opioids, there's all these other things that are going on that really we didn't hear of in the past, but really we use alcohol and drugs for the same reasons, and our details may be different, but the stories are really the same. And to me, that's comforting, because it also shows that recovery is so attainable and so powerful. And that's what I love about what I get to do now, is talk about the fact that, yeah, I mean, I'm not proud of where I was. I do believe it's a disease. I believe it's a disease with a choice component.
Okay.
So the only thing I regret, though, about my alcoholism is the hurt that I caused others, because I did go down a road that seemed to have been the antithesis of what everybody thought I was, because I looked really good on the outside, especially with my running and winning overall races in Roanoke and running, you know, qualifying for Boston 5 times. But even Boston, John, I qualified for Boston 5 times but never ran it, because I had this fear. I had kind of this, and
you weren't
I hear
ready
this a
for
lot
the big
too.
Time?
I didn't, I don't know. I was, I think for me, again, everybody's story is a little bit different, but I've heard this a lot, especially with addicts in recovery, is that we had this perfect storm of arrogance and fear. Because you're arrogant, you're going to handle it yourself, you're going to outrun it, you're going to do whatever, you're going to muscle through. But there's so much fear of failure that's what finally took me down and
take us
and
to
getting
that point.
Humility. Yes.
Take me to that point where it was the lowest of the low.
Okay, long story short there, I did experience 3 DUIs within 18 months.
Okay,
after
it wasn't one epiphany per se. It was a bunch of things that kind of finally struck you over the head.
Yeah, but it was an epiphany. It was an epiphany one day when it was even a couple of months after my 3rd DUI. Everybody would think, well, my God, after 1 DUI, well, after 2, well, after 3, you're for sure, you're done. But it, again, because it is a disease, and by that point, I really didn't know what side was up or down, and I was just not in a good place. But I remember one day, and this is pretty dark, but I didn't want to live. And so the only good thing about that now is I do at least have an idea of what that feels like. It wasn't a sadness. It wasn't an anger. It wasn't even a fear. It was an emptiness and a feeling like
it was a resignation.
Yeah. It was like, I know I can't ever get over this, but I don't know what to do. I want Tom to be with someone else because he's an incredible man. I want my girls to have a good mom. But the thing that stopped me that day, John, and I'll never forget it, I was in my bedroom, was the fact that I could not do it and not have my girls grow up with their mom taking their life. And as weird as that sounds, that
taking
by the grace
their life.
Taking her life,
okay.
Yes. So by the grace of God, that made me go, okay, that's not a frickin' option now. And that was almost an angry feeling because I thought, well, I don't know what to do. So I did, because I had at that point tried several different forms of treatment, everything other than residential treatment. And, you know, there's lots of different roads to recovery, but for me, for this alcoholic, it did take residential treatment. So I finally... we figured out a way, and we got me to a place in Williamsburg, Virginia. And, you know, there's no magic pixie dust there. It was a great place. It was where I found my foundation. But the turning point for me was literally surrendering. It really, you know, it's weird because it's in one area of my life, actually my faith and my recovery, where surrender equals freedom. And I grew up being very successful and, you know, in a good way. And the world rewards that. The world rewards us. And it's not the world's fault either, but the world says, you know, you push through and you keep, you know, succeeding. And that's what we are supposed to be doing. But what I really needed to be doing was following directions. Like when I went to outpatient treatment, when I went to meetings, when I talked to other people that were sober that I knew I wanted to follow, I just never really followed the directions. And that's what humility is to me today, is knowing when to go, okay, yeah, I'm pretty smart, I'm pretty creative, I can do stuff, but I also need to know when to just follow the flipping directions and stop thinking, oh, I'm gonna think out of the side of the box and do it my way. So even in running, that's true. And, you know, after 60 some marathons and 35 ultras and all the other things I've been allowed to do, I love following my coach's directions. I'm coached now by Sandy Nypaver, who's a former incredible ultra runner. And following her plan just for the past year and a half has changed me as a runner, mainly even mentally and emotionally. And that part has been the biggest gift to me.
Is this Pam being rediscovered as an elite runner before all the other stuff kind of got in the way?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for putting it that way. And
Did the stuff get in the way, or did you put it in the way?
Oh, I put it in the
way. You put it in the
way. Oh, yeah. That was a choice. That was a choice.
Clearly.
And again, I'm not proud of it, but I'm actually, what I am proud of or grateful for is the fact that I can admit that now.
Okay.
And not blame something else or blame circumstances or make excuses. And yeah, we have so much power in this life in our choices. Many of us have circumstances. I mean, in my circumstances, I created a lot of my problem, you know, and but many of us have circumstances that we can, and again, I don't want to sound corny, John, but we can rise above or push through or go around or sometimes not do anything and just be still. And that was another thing I had to, I continue to learn. Yeah. I mean, I just celebrated 13 years of sobriety. So the best way for me to explain that too is that I have no desire to drink or use drugs or anything today. Thank God. And there are people with more sobriety than me that deal with that desire every day. And I respect their program and the way they deal
but
with
not
it.
Not for you.
I don't. I have no desire at all. And I'm like the happiest designated driver you'll ever meet. I'm serious. I'm almost like arrogant, but I'm like,
where am I going?
Yeah, please let me be. So, but on the other hand, it's the program though. It's the, which that word used to annoy the crap out of me too. It's like, I'm not going to be in a program the rest of my life. That's just, I can't do that. That's weird. That's too much of a burden. Well, opposite is true. My program is living in, it's not even about, I love 12 steps. I mean, anybody listening, if you haven't read the 12 steps, read them because they have nothing to do with drugs and alcohol, really. But I love having to be, I'm not perfect. I'm not, you know, I still struggle every day, but I love being, living in a more genuine life, and so much of that revolves around gratitude too. I've been called obnoxiously grateful, which is fine with me because I do. I thought it would fade over time, but no way. Especially as I experience life as a sober person, especially as a mom, as a friend, different things that, you know, again, I don't think about drinking, but I think about, wow, the old me would have either done this or done that. But no, this is a different me. And I'm thankful for that. And
as much as you gave, as much as you put yourself in the position, you kind of threw all those obstacles in your way by being an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Can you get to the point where you credit yourself for climbing out and being in charge of your recovery, with running being a big aspect of that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I think I have. I know I have found a way to credit myself or celebrate myself without the arrogance and without the without being complacent. Because again, even though I say I don't have a desire to drink or drug, I'm never going to be complacent about that. I still take that one day at a time. So even with my running, John, another thing I say is I don't run to stay sober. I get to run because I am. Because another part, especially where I am right today as we sit here, I'm in a really good place with my running. I mean, I just turned 57 the other day, but I just ran my 60th marathon. I qualified for Boston again. My work with Heron Project. I don't get paid to run, but I get to run as part of my job with all of these incredible people across the country that run with us and for us to raise money and resources to help people get in and stay in recovery. So that never, any day of the week, never ceases to amaze me. So yeah, that I can celebrate. That I can say, wow. Some of it's been the good fortune. Some of it's been, you know, just the grace of God. And some of it's been a little bit of luck, but a lot of it has been me showing up day after day.
How did the Heron Project, your connection to it, and describe what you actually do for it? How did that come about for you?
Oh, that's another long story, which I will cut down to just a few
words.
I'm sure
you have a Cliff Notes.
It's fun. I do. It's such a fun running story, though. Someday I'll have to tell you the whole thing. It actually started with the 2013 Boston Marathon jacket that I had signed by Bart Yasso, Frank Rogers, and Bill Shorter, Mev Kozleski. They had all signed my jacket at different times, and of course the 2013 jacket was very memorable because of that year. Yep. Anyway, I then was going back to run the 2014 Boston Marathon, and Runner's World did a story on it for their online version and said, who do you want to get to sign your jacket when you come back next year? Tom and I had just watched Chris Herron's 30 for 30 called Unguarded and read his book Basketball Junkie. And of course, being in recovery, and I knew that Chris was running it for his charity, Heron Project, and knew that John Hancock, actually, they didn't even have a running program to be an official charity of the race, but John Hancock gave Chris three bibs to run the race.
Cool.
It's kind of as a one and done. So anyway, I say that I want to meet, I'm being interviewed, and just thanks to your profession, thanks to social media, they asked who I would have sign the jacket. I said, well, I don't want to walk around like a groupie with a Sharpie, but if I happen to see Chris Herron, I'd want him to. I don't even think he's a runner, but I know he's
because
running.
Because of my alcoholism?
Yeah, because of his story. Yeah. And so they tweeted it out. Sure enough, Chris Herron. They tag him in Herron Project. He tweets back, I'd be honored to sign your jacket. So we met at the expo and signed my jacket. Blah, blah, blah. Long story short, what happened after that is we stayed connected somewhat, and his folks, marketing director Jenny Swider and his best friend from childhood, who is in the 30 for 30 and is now the executive director of Herron Project, Kevin Michalazik, he ran the marathon with Chris. And so I got to meet him that weekend. Well, we kind of stayed in touch, and they had people contacting them after the marathon, after Chris finished it, because it was such a cool story. It took him 6 hours. He said, you know, it was humbling for him, even though he had a blast. He was like, this is, you know, because he's
a
phenomenal athlete.
Yeah,
still is. Anyway, so he said, so they said, we have all these people wanting to run with us or for us, and we don't have a running initiative, and, you know, no offense. But they even joked, they said, no offense, but we don't want to have a running program. And I said, no offense taken. I said, because they kind of, and I would have thought the same thing. They thought, oh, we're going to have to put on 5Ks or whatever. Well, anyway, so they said, would you help us figure out what to do just as a volunteer? And I was like, yes, absolutely. Well, that turned into a lot of people. Fortunately, because of the power of our sport, because of not just of any sport, but especially the sport of running, and because a lot of other charities were raising funds for their causes, because of that, and because of the good news of the stigma being broken down, finally, of the stigma of addiction. And because not that long ago, I mean, when I was first sober and I was raising money for a couple of other organizations, it was a little bit harder. I mean, it was actually a lot harder because, first of all, it was odd. Oh, you're raising money for what? And not only was it unusual, but some people were against it. No, we're not helping people that are addicts, okay? No. They need to, it was just not, it, because of the stigma. So okay. Whether it was right or wrong, it was the way it was. So anyway, but I was finding so much interest for them. And, you know, I mean, I happen to work for them now, so I'm biased, but I do see it from the inside. They were, even back then, 5 years ago, doing incredible work. And it blew me away. And I said, you guys, you don't have to put on 5Ks, but you can engage these people that want to run with you in other ways. So we made up a job as we went along, and in the fall of 2014, they took a chance on me, I took a chance on them, I quit my other job, which was full-time raising development with YMCAs, and I was the right person at the right place at the right time. Here I was, a runner in recovery, my degree is in journalism, but I have a lot of experience in financial development, and so for nonprofits.
Sure.
So it worked out, and so I said, yeah, let's try this. So I quit my job and I went on with them full time, and that was 4.5 years ago. So it was called THP Runs, the Herron Project Runs. It's now called Team Herron Project. My job title is Director of Active Engagement, and I work full-time for them out of my home office in Virginia and travel to races. We have everything from the Boston Marathon, New York City Marathon, to triathlons, 5Ks. We have, right now, as we speak, hi, Nick. I'll talk to you. We have 650 runners across the country.
That are
22 ambassadors.
That are all linked to the Herron Project.
That run, yeah, raise funds and awareness.
Raise funds.
In 4.5 years, we've raised $1.3 million. And that says so much about not only our power of the power of sport, but the power of our stories, because that $1.3 million was raised from runners, not, you know, through grants or other development that we have, which is great for the work of Herron Project, but all of this was done by all these people. So it's not me.
Yeah.
I call myself the doorman, because I get to like open the door and these people come, and there's we have had an unusual situation where people have stayed with us. We have a private Facebook page, and Facebook is Facebook, but sometimes it can be really powerful.
Yes.
And in our case, it has been, to where people not only do more than one event with us, but they meet up, they develop their own events. We've got everyone from, we've got an incredible lady here in Northeast Ohio, Christy Sievers, who's one of our ambassadors.
Yes, Christy.
I don't know if you knew about the Lakeshore
Mini
Ultra.
Yeah,
that was for Heron.
That was
all her idea. We supported her. We sent her all the stuff.
She's run ultras. She's run hundreds. Yes, I know
she's
Christy.
She's a tremendous.
She's a great person.
She's what I call a force for good. And talk about humble. She'd be mad right now that I'm
talking about her. Yeah.
But sorry, Christy, you deserve it. You earn it. And we need to share stories like yours. So, and the cool thing too, John, one more thing I want to point out is that out of these 650 and then all the people that are connected with them, we're not all in recovery. A lot of people either are supporting someone who is. My least favorite reason or way to meet people is because they've lost someone. And there's nothing else you can do other than try to heal yourself and help others. So we really focus on the family. It is about it's a family disease. The family has to be supported.
Especially
if the addict or the sick person who's sick doesn't want to get help, because you can't force that. And so, but that doesn't mean the family still needs to stay in that madness of the disease. So we focus a lot on helping that and on treatment navigation and aftercare, because someone can go to treatment, but like with me, like I said, there's no magic in Williamsburg. When I left there on May 18th, is today May 18th?
It is, Yeshua. It is.
it was 13 years ago today. I walked out of treatment.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and that's when the real fear started, because it was like, now what?
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, you can't wait to get out of there, but on the other hand, you don't know what, you know, that was safe there. And then in my particular story, I had to serve 3 months in jail 6 months later because of consequences. And I did deserve that. I did need to. Thank God I never hurt myself or anybody else. But that's a reality of this disease too, is it is not just you're not just hurting yourself. As we know, the casualties are all around. So it's gotten a little bit worse. But the beauty is that it's getting better, and I'd like to work myself out of a job. I would love Heron Project to not have to exist, but until it does, we are, there's so many other organizations like us too that are now collaborating instead of worrying about, doing our own thing. We collaborate, we are with each other, we're with government entities, we're with other treatment centers, because we gotta, this is a thing that we gotta do together. And whether it's addiction or whatever, there's a lot of darkness in this world, but.
Yeah.
There's so much power in our light, and in shining that. And again, that sounds corny, but I see it every single day.
Yeah, it's crazy that you've been able to unpack your life story, in the sense that you're an individual that you wanted perfection, you wanted to be great at what you did, but you were afraid to be great.
Yes.
The alcohol made you feel better in some ways.
Absolutely.
But then as you continue along your life story, you realize that the only way to get out of this is by myself.
Yep.
I mean,
absolutely.
People, programs
and ask
are great.
For help.
And ask
for help. Not and follow directions.
Not be afraid to do just that.
To do just that, exactly.
And don't you see a lot of former alcoholics that they're running ultras, or they're kind of changing that emphasis and going long form the other
absolutely.
Way?
Absolutely.
Would you put yourself,
John,
in that category?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And a lot of times people will ask me and others, well, aren't you just trading addictions? And first of all, I don't want to be flip, but I guess my sarcastic answer is, if so, fine, because this is not, although I have to say, I do put my program or use my tools or however you want to put it onto my running, because I could let that get out of control. I could get all up in my head, either worrying or being super, so proud of myself that I just, ran across the country or I just did this or that. But that humility thing is always there. That's the first thing that I use as a tool. So anyway, I use, one of the things that I was afraid of when I was presented with the opportunity to change was, even though I hated who I was, I hated myself at the time.
Okay.
The irony was, I was afraid to change because I didn't want to be a different person. And the truth was, I didn't need to be a different me. I needed to be the real me, right? The me that wasn't trying to always alter myself or find relief through, you know, some other avenue, ultimately alcohol. So when I realized that the real me, yeah, I am wired that way. I'm wired to move and to push the boundaries a little bit. I love ultras, John, because I choose that discomfort too. That's the other thing. I know you've done Burning River, and that's one of my best examples, because that's probably the hardest ultra I've ever done. And overcoming that for me was a big deal, because I'm a road runner and that's a lot of trail, blah, blah, blah. But there were so many points of darkness where I wanted to quit. Now, would it have been wrong to quit? No, I mean, that's my own choice. But I knew that I chose this. I'm not sick or injured, so I can choose to push through this. And that is such a fabulous feeling, knowing that I'm able to do that. And yeah. So that's how I use it. It mirrors recovery a lot to me, because I don't care who you are or how many wonderful resources and income or
your
life
recovery
or
is not going to be perfect every
day. No, and you have to choose to go through the dark times, and then even better, learn from them and grow them. And so far, that's where I am. So I'm not perfect. I haven't arrived. But man, is this journey beautiful and messy. And I like messy now. And I used to be, and I wouldn't tolerate it. But now I love it. So,
Pam, you are a life force. And I can't thank
I'm
you
enough.
I'm
surrounded by them like you.
No, I
thank
can't,
you.
I can't thank you enough for our chat. Many blessings to you.
Thank you, sir.
I also want to point out that Pam was featured in the book called A Race Like No Other, written by New York Times writer Liz Robbins. Maybe you'll get a chance to check that out. And also, who knows, you just may run into Pam at your next race. She's absolutely an inspiring personality. She's a longtime resident of Virginia in the Roanoke area and is the mother of three girls, a mother-in-law, and a very proud grandmother. Great having on our pod once again the great sounding Pam Rickard. By the way, originally from Northeast Ohio. Thanks very much for listening to the pod. As usual, hope that you can help us grow the podcast by sharing, rating, and or reviewing on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again for listening, and we'll check you guys out the next time around on the next edition of Telich Talks.